Okay, Senate State Affairs is called to order. It's 9:08. It's February the 1st. We do have a quorum to conduct business. Present for the record are Senators French, Stevens, Green, and myself, McGuire. We have three items up on the agenda today. The first item that we will bring up is, I actually want to go ahead and just bring Senate Bill number 45 up, if the sponsor's ready. Maybe they're not. They're not? Okay, so we'll go ahead and bring up Senate Bill 19, then Senate Bill 20, the intent to move them out today, and then Senate Bill 45, all with the intent to move. So Senate Bill number 19 was before us. We had public testimony. We have two individuals online. One is Dan Wayne, our attorney in legal services, who's done the bill drafting. He's online to answer any questions the committee might have. And then there is one other individual that wants to testify on Senate Bill number 20 when we get to that. Although, let me ask him, in Ketchikan, Stuart Thompson, do you want to testify on Senate Bill 19 as well? That's before us. First, the Executive Branch Ethics Act.
Madam Chairman, I would, for efficiency and appropriateness, I should testify on SB 20.
Okay, fantastic. So we'll wait and get to you. Anybody else here in the audience? I'll reopen public testimony on Senate Bill number 19, the Executive Branch Ethics, Interests, and Actions Act. Anybody online I've overlooked? Okay, so hearing and seeing none, I'll go ahead and close public testimony.
Yes, this is Dave Jones.
Pardon?
With the Attorney General's Office. I'm online.
Okay, just to answer questions, though, correct, Dave?
Well, actually, I did want to address a couple things with respect to Senate Bill 19.
Okay, my apologies. It said answer questions, so please go ahead and offer your testimony.
Thank you. Madam Chair, my name is Dave Jones. I'm with the Attorney General's Office in Anchorage. Of course, we're all after the same goal of trying to improve the Executive Branch Ethics Act and other disclosure and ethics requirements in state law. The governor has introduced a bill which in the House is House Bill 109 that addresses this same issue in Section 8 of that bill. One of the differences between Section 8 of the governor's bill and Senate Bill 19 as amended is that we don't include the percentage requirement for an interest in a business. We deal strictly with a dollar standard, the $5,000 standard, that also appears in Senate Bill 19. This issue came up in the Senate Judiciary Committee. I understand that there's some members of that committee, including members of this committee, that had some concerns about eliminating the percentage requirement. One of our concerns is
Senator French?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Jones, could you direct us to a line on SB 20 that you're referring to?
And just for the record, Shalon has passed out the governor's bill, which is Senate Bill number 64, just for the members' reference as well. So if you could clarify, Mr. Jones, are you referring to Senate Bill 64 or Senate Bill number 19?
At this time, I'm referring to Senate Bill 19.
Okay, and what page and line?
I'm referring to pages 1 and 2. On page 1, the lines begin at line 12 and extend into line 20
okay.
of page 2. And I apologize, it is, of course, Senate Bill 64 that we're referring to, which is the Senate version of the governor's bill.
Okay, and your point is that you'd rather have, I mean, just to simplify here, tell me if I get it wrong. Your point is that you would prefer to have a simple dollar figure as opposed to a percentage.
That's correct. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I recall that debate, Senator French, I know you will too, in your committee.
Madam Chair.
Okay.
I don't see where it mentions the percentage on the lines that Mr. Jones mentioned. Could he direct us to that?
Did you say you were referring to Senate Bill 64 now?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, the lines in Senate Bill 19 that refer to percentages are lines 8 of page 2.
1%.
Okay, thank you.
and lines 11 and 12 on page 2.
That's right. And we, Senator French, remember we discussed that in Judiciary.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember. I just remember that we were a little concerned at just leaving it at a dollar amount. So, but it's the administration's testimony that you would prefer not to have a percentage, and then just could you state one more time why you think just the dollar amount's enough?
Well, I think a dollar amount is enough because our goal is, of course, to treat those instances in which a public officer's interest is significant. And if we get into a percentage, we could have 1% of a $1,000 venture, which would be a $10 interest. And I'm not sure that that's going to help us in getting toward the ultimate goal, which is to deal with those instances in which public officers have significant interests. If we get beyond that, one of the consequences of the amendments to Senate Bill 19 is that on lines 5 and 6 of page 2, a controlling interest in a business is disqualifying if that controlling interest has a fair market value of $5,000 or more. But if we look at lines 8 and 9, and lines 11 and 12 on the same page, if a person has a 1% interest in a business, regardless of whether that 1% interest is worth $1 or $1 million, that interest is disqualifying. So a person could be disqualified under lines 8 and 9 and lines 11 and 12 for having a 1% interest that's worth $1 or $100 or $1,000, but under lines 5 and 6 would be disqualified only if the controlling interest had a fair market value of $5,000 or more.
Madam Chair.
Yeah, Senator French.
Mr. Jones, thank you. Your point's well taken. Maybe you can educate the committee as to the historical background of that one percentage amount. It's something we've seen in the other states have used it. It's something we saw discussed extensively a couple of years ago when this was in the headlines. And maybe you can just give us a little bit of a idea about why this percentage value ever crept into the statutes in the first place.
Senator French, through the chair, I can only speculate. I'm not personally familiar with that background. I suspect that some folks believe that a 1% interest may be in some instances easier to measure than a dollar value, because there may be times at which the value of an interest, the dollar value of an interest, is difficult to assess. Our concern is that, in fact, it's more likely to be difficult to assess the percentage value, particularly where we're dealing with various levels of stock or various classes of stock, such as preferred stock or common stock, and where we're dealing with options, stock options. You know, do you count the option as part of the 100% whole, or do you exclude it? And how are we going to determine how many options are out there if we are to include stock options as part of the 100% whole? So I can't really address your question right on all points because I'm not familiar with the background. But I suspect that it was rooted in some concerns about the difficulty of finding a dollar value.
I think I recall Representative Guerra, too, bringing up the point that, you know, when you have a high-value stock like an Exxon, a large company, that if you had a 1% interest in ExxonMobil, it may well not be. It certainly would not be a controlling interest, and it would certainly be more than $5,000. And I think that was the concern, at least over in the other body last year when we were looking at an either-or provision, because sometimes the dollar figure makes sense, and sometimes you're dealing in such large companies and high-value stock that really the percentage gives you more information than the dollar figure would. So, Senator Stevens?
I just want to clarify. I think I understand what the fair market value means, but when you you're talking about the value of a stock at the present time, not maybe what you purchased it for, but what it is now valued at a fair market. Is that right? That's how you come up with a $5,000 matter?
Senator Stevens, through the chair, that's correct. We look at the current value because that's relevant not only to whether the public officer might be influenced by that interest in taking official action, but also in how the public would perceive it.
So fairly easy to figure that, right? And I can see why you would have a harder time trying to come up with 1%. I think that makes more sense.
Okay, Senator Bundy has joined us, but Senator Bundy?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm certainly all in favor of the public being informed and aware of potential conflicts, but I'm just interested in the mechanics here and knowing the vagaries of the stock market. Is it possible that a person could weekly, if not daily, possibly hourly, go in and out of compliance because their stock is worth more or less than $5,000.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, that is certainly possible if somebody owns an interest that's near that $5,000 cutoff. That is certainly possible. And, of course, the same would be true with respect to percentage ownership. As shares are sold or additional stock is issued, that could change from time to time.
So I'm wondering if more a basket or something would be appropriate. I mean, if you were dealing in, if I might, Madam Chair, if you're dealing in futures, for instance, they surely could vary more than $5,000 over a period of 24 hours or certainly a week. And my concern is, I'm not dealing in those issues, and I doubt that any of that would apply to me, but my concern is some people who fall into inadvertent ethical violations.
Okay. Further, Senator French.
Just on the 1% issue, Madam Chair, I guess I'm just wondering out loud whether they're I mean, Mr. Jones makes a point that you could own 1% of a very small company, be in an ethical violation for having an insignificant amount in an insignificant company. But I guess my counterargument to that is, you know, how realistic is that? How many companies actually go through the trouble of issuing stock and issuing ownership, and you know, how many executive branch employees actually own shares in a company that's basically valueless? And then take action respecting that business, and I guess it'd be fairly small. Whereas the flip side is that there is a likelihood that you would own 1% of a local real estate LLC, or own 1% of a local restaurant, or own 1% of a local tourism business. And at that level, we would, I think, all agree that you should not be making or taking official action affecting that investment while you sit in a state office chair. And so I guess while I think Mr. Jones's point is good that you might sometimes create a problem, I guess I sort of take a belt and suspenders approach to this and think both is a good way of capturing the idea that you shouldn't get too close to the line.
Okay, further discussion? Further testimony, Mr. Jones, that you'd like to offer on Senate Bill 19?
Just one point. Thank you, Madam Chair. The provision in the governor's bill that I referred to is in Senate Bill 64 on page 6, lines 24 through 26. And what we propose there is a presumption that stock or other ownership interest is insignificant if it's less than $5,000 in value. The advantage of a presumption is that it deals with both those situations where a business interest really is significant, and those situations where even though the value of that interest may currently be less than $5,000, the official action that the officer is taking has the potential to really increase the value of that interest. For example, if I have a $4,000 interest and I can take action that will increase the value of that interest to $40,000, this presumption allows us under the Ethics Act to address that situation by saying, okay, even though it's under $5,000 now, because this would stand to benefit you so dramatically, you may not, consistent with the Ethics Act, take official action on that matter.
How would that play out, though? I mean, so it would be a presumption that would have to be rebutted. So if you don't have disclosure of it, how would you find it out, and how would you, what would be the process by which you'd go through?
But, in the same way that we go through, Madam Chair, the same process that we follow now. We rely on public officers to self-report, and when that doesn't occur, we rely on their coworkers and members of the public to report.
Okay, further testimony? Okay, anybody else? Okay, so hearing none, we'll close testimony on Senate Bill number 19 and amendments. I have one amendment that I've prepared, just since it's right here, and I'll offer that. It's amendment number one. I'll go ahead and move it, and if somebody would object, so I can explain it.
Object.
Okay. So amendment number one, what that would do, page one, following line two, following interest in prohibiting certain persons from engaging in activities as lobbyists. And then page two, following line 20, to section two, I'd like to amend it to read, this is the revolving door provision. So it already in statute says a former governor, lieutenant governor, or head of a principal department of the executive branch can't engage as a lobbyist for a period of 1 year. So that's already current statute. The discussion has been to expand it to a deputy head, and that's come from Governor Palin herself. So this amendment incorporates that concept. I think it's a good one. You can be a deputy head and be fairly high up in negotiations on certain issues, and so I think that's not a bad provision. But I am expanding it just a little further to say that if you are the chair of a state board or commission which has the authority to adopt regulations, or the employee of the office of governor in a policymaking position. And the reason that I'm doing that, I don't want to point fingers, but some of you will recall at least the inferences surrounding the Regulatory Commission of Alaska 6 years ago. And there was an individual that served as chair for many years and then went immediately into the private sector as a highly paid CEO of one of the phone companies. And it rubbed a lot of people wrong. Again, it's the appearance of it. I'm not here to say it was real or not, but it was the appearance of it that bothered people. And I think that when you're in that position where you are the chair of a regulatory authority where you can adopt regulations, my position is you may even have more power than a lieutenant governor or a deputy head. I mean, you may. So that's the amendment. And then the rest is just technical. There's an applicability section. And I'm open to discussion. It's an idea that I thought we could incorporate into the bill. Senator Stevens.
Just a question, Madam Chair. Now, who are we looking at? Is the chair of a state board or commission with the authority to adopt regulations? Would that be like the Minister RCA, but also, say, the University of Regents, the railroad? Would they be included in that, other agencies that you can think
Shalon,
of?
Did you ever get a list? Okay. So we could get a list. We narrowed it down because we didn't want to say simply the chair of any state board or commission. Because we got into, you know, you could be the hairdressers and the barbers and, you know, those types of positions. But it's those that have the authority to adopt regulations. And the one that I came to is RCA. I don't know if the railroad does have that authority. Dan is? Okay. And so, Dan, Wayne, are you there? Could you helped us draft the amendment. Would you be able to point to those boards or commissions? You know, we narrowed it from just the chair of any state board or commission to those that have the authority to adopt regulations.
Right. And since then, since I drafted this, I've been looking through to see who has power to adopt regulations, and a lot of boards and commissions do. For example, the Limited Entry Commission, the Real Estate Commission, the Board of Fisheries and Game, Board of Psychologists and Psychological Associate Examiners. And then there's actually there's some, I didn't know this, but there's some directors that have power to adopt regulations too, like the director of the insurance division. And there may be a few other directors in the state that can actually adopt regulations. But what I'm trying to figure out is a way to exclude commissions and boards that mainly perform, you know, licensing functions and things like that. And I think I'm close to coming up with a solution, but I don't have one yet.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator French.
Couple questions. One, I just wonder whether this amendment would fix the factual scenario you presented us with. Did the former head of the RCA go to a lobbying position or simply a private industry position? Or was it both?
For someone they had previously regulated. They went to work for someone they had previously regulated.
I see.
But this
prohibits engaging in activity as a lobbyist.
Yeah.
So you can
might want to expand it.
Is there another provision that is there another statute that covers that scenario? Because there is the revolving door where you're not supposed to go to you're not supposed to leave state service and go to a place where you are suddenly working for the people you used to regulate. I think that's the provision that Senator Green's referring to. But this is just, you can't go lobby after you've been a certain high government official.
No, I think you make a great point. This would cover the case of lobbyists, and I don't know the full description of the title, you know, of the job that she took. Certainly, there would likely be some lobbying back to that very board or knowledge of in relationship with that very board with respect to decisions being, and remember when I say lobbying, we kind of think of the legislature, but it's to lobby back to that regulatory authority board that regulates your industry. So if you are a telephone company.
In any scenario.
Yes. If you are a telephone company, it's not about us here in the legislature, but it is about the RCA, or if you were a utility company or an oil and gas company. So it's those lobbying activities back to that commission. But I'm open to any language. I'm throwing this out here. I'm open to any language that you think would make it better. Senator Stevens.
Well, I'm not ready to offer you any language, Madam Chairman, I think it goes right back to the issue we've been struggling with. I mean, we all know what we want to do, where we want to go, what we want to control, and how we want to make sure that there's not an opportunity for skullduggery here. But on the other hand, it's always a matter of definition of how do you define things. I mean, as I look at this, I see that someone who serves on the Board of Fish and Game might not be allowed to. They're certainly not regulating people they might go to work for, but they might. I mean, they might go to work for a fishing company, for, you know. So I we got to be very careful what we do here, because you could be denying people an opportunity to make a living that is quite legitimate. I'm just concerned about taking a broad swath of this and causing problems for people when that's not our intention.
Further discussion, Senator Bundy, and then Senator Green.
Yeah, thank you. Just looking at the other side of the coin, this is not a lifetime prohibition. It says you have to sit out 1 year. That may allow some of those close personal relationships to cool some. But if they have a talent and experience and ability that is a saleable commodity, having to wait a year isn't all that onerous, I wouldn't think. So maybe some of the salaries some lobbyists make, maybe it would be onerous, but even so, a year isn't a lifetime prohibition.
Senator Green?
When we were doing, thank you, Madam Chair, when we were doing the Agricultural Conservation Board. We were broached with the idea that, or we were told that if we, the governor appointed people to that board, we would not have the ability to approve them. And it had to do something with their fiduciary responsibility. And so there's another level of boards besides the typical licensing provisions and the organization of the industry that sits out there. And I wonder if those are the boards you're talking about. I don't know how it's defined, but it's those who not only can adopt regulations, but also have somehow they control some money in their description, and not all boards do. I don't know if that comes any closer, but I'm very concerned if you, because I do think the power to adopt regulations is very, very wide.
Well, and let's just, at least for now, not getting into the broader discussion that Senator French brought up about whether or not you can leave as chair and go on to do work for a company. So far, that's not included. So what we're saying is if you are the chair, that's not just a member, but you're the chair, so you're in a position of significant power in a board or commission which has the authority to adopt regulations, you can engage in activity as a lobbyist for 1 year. So really, it's not as broad as the discussions have gone today. It's simply saying you cannot engage in lobbying activities. Now, you know, people will still be able, if they wanted, I suspect, to go on in the scenario Senator Stevens proposed. You're on the board of Fish and Game to go work for a fisheries company. You just can't go to work for them as a lobbyist to lobby the very board that you just chaired in a policymaking role for 1 year. And I mean, I think that's appropriate. And I think what we're trying to get at is when you're in these positions of authority for this year, you don't want to have a situation where the appearance or the reality is that somebody is using that year as an opportunity to curry favor, to steer regulating writing authority, to steer decision making or negotiations in a direction of somebody who they will ultimately benefit from privately. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just why stop at the chair? Because when I think of Fish and Game, for example, I mean, members have almost as much authority as the chair does to direct regulation. So, I mean, could you tell me again the rationale for just including the chair and not the members of, say, the Board of Regents or the Railroad or RCA or, you know, it seems to me like all members have enormous power. Why just the chair?
Madam Chair, this is Dan Wayne in Legal.
Dan.
May I respond to that through the chair?
Sure, and then I'll respond. Yeah.
I'm sorry I'm not there to raise my hand, but first of all, I looked at the rest of 3952-180 that we're talking about here today, and doesn't show up in the bill, but it says that a public officer who leaves state service may not, for 2 years after leaving state service, represent, advise, or assist a person for compensation regarding a matter that was under consideration by the administrative unit served by that public officer. And it goes on to say some other things. But the gist of it is what I think Senator French pointed out earlier, is that the scenario that Madam Chair brought up about the person leaving a regulatory commission and going to work for a utility company seems to be addressed there, although it doesn't talk about lobbying. So with respect to lobbyists, I guess I don't know the answer to the question there that Senator Stevens asked there. I mean, why limit it to commissioner board heads? I guess it's a policy call. There's one other thing that I wanted to say that might be helpful to the committee. And in response to what Senator Green said a moment ago, I think that we might be able to separate it out by saying that boards and commissions that fall under AS 801-010 would be excluded from this provision, because that's a chapter that deals with centralized licensing, and it has a long list in the of boards that are covered by it, and it doesn't include things like the Limited Entry Commission, the Board of Fisheries, the Regulatory Board. It includes things like the Board of Nursing, Board of Pharmacy, Big Game Commercial Services, Board of Dental Examiners, and things of that nature, and it has to do with licensing. That's all.
And that's the chapter under centralized licensing.
Right. So
just to ask Mr. Jones to clarify, are you saying, Mr. Jones, that a member of, say, the RCA would have less opportunity for mischief than, say, the chair? Is that your point? I'm sorry, the wrong person there. They're our last speaker.
Dan Wayne.
Dan?
No, I'm not saying that. I think that obviously in some ways a chair of any body has a different type of authority. And some people might say that it's, greater than the members have. But depending on, the makeup of a board or a commission, somebody who is always the swing vote, for example, can have tremendous power. So it's really a difficult thing to pin down.
Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and move an amendment to the amendment and allow Mr. Wayne to do it in the right place, which would be to exempt those boards and commissions under 801-010 in centralized licensing. It's things like the Board of Veterinary Examiners, concert promoters, dental examiners, certified direct entry midwives, nutritionists, and so forth. Even agencies that perform euthanasia services. Goodness sake. So I'm gonna.
How do you apply that?
So I'll do it as a conforming amendment. I give you the latitude to put it where you think is appropriate. Is that doable, Mr. Wayne?
Yes.
Okay. So that's the amendment to the amendment before the committee right now would be to exempt those centralized licensing, and if anybody wants to see it. Okay. Senator French?
Not to the amendment to the amendment.
Okay.
Subsequent.
So any discussion or objection to the amendment to the amendment? No. Hearing none, the amendment to the amendment carries, bringing amendment number one back before us as amended for further discussion. Senator French.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a second amendment to the amendment, and that would be to add, it looks as if we're capturing the governor, lieutenant governor, commissioners, now deputy commissioners, that's what a deputy head is. I'd like to add division directors. I think in many departments, division directors, particularly in the oil and gas and the tax and the revenue areas, and sometimes in DEC, just carry enormous amounts of power over the industries that they're regulating. And to let them turn around and come back as lobbyists immediately, I think strikes many folks as being just a little too close. Again, you may be able to go get a job in private industry and use the knowledge you've gained if you're not involved in a matter that you've had under your consideration, that's fair. But to come back in the halls and lobby, a month after you've left one of those jobs is, I think, a little too close. So that'd be my amendment to the amendment, would be to add division directors.
Okay. Is there discussion on the amendment to the amendment? Okay. Hearing no objection, that carries. So we have the amendment back before us as amended for further discussion from the committee. Senator Stevens, do you maintain your objection to
the amendment? Yes.
Okay. Discussion, Senator Green.
Yeah. And a couple of commissions and boards that I've been on, I found the executive director far more powerful than the chair. And, I mean, we can reach down way far. But the executive director generally sets out the agenda and determines what's on the calendar for the day, and is the one who's really in the know, and the chair is sort of the head who comes in and gavels everyone in. And I don't know if you want to have that for discussion or if that's getting way outside.
It's up to the committee. I mean, we're kind of in an area we haven't been, so I'm open to. And I think we've already gone to second degree amendment, so maybe we should just dispense with this, and then we could add that as an amendment number two if people felt. Okay, so there's an objection maintained. Madam Secretary, will you call the roll on amendment number one as amended?
Senator French?
Yes.
Senator Green?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Chair McGuire?
Yes. Okay, so amendment number one is carried. That brings us back to Senator Green's concept. So the idea would be, in addition to a division director and the chair of these certain boards and commissions, not including the sort of the licensure commissions, we've excluded them, should the executive director of some of these, I guess it would be defined the same way. Of that, is that, would that be the intent? The executive director of the board or commission. Mm-hmm. Is there a committee discussion on that idea, Senator French?
I think we're all just. I just need some more information, maybe from someone who knows about boards and commissions. Who these individuals are? Are they always state employees? What's their pay range? I mean, yeah,
Mr. Wayne, I know we're really pushing you here. Any idea about, is there any statutory reference to who that executive director would be? Are they a state employee? And do you have any information for the committee?
If I can have just a couple more minutes, I'm doing a search for the term executive director in my database and hoping to come up with something.
Okay.
I'm just trying to think of an example, the Board of Fish or...
The executive director is hired generally by the board.
So they'd
released
be...
They'd by be the board.
Sure, they'd be state employees. Mm-hmm.
State employees.
Yeah. Do
they
all
work at the
boards,
pleasure of the committee.
Okay, and do all boards and commissions get an executive director? Are they all entitled to one?
I don't know that each is entitled to one because some are handled, I think, through the division.
Okay.
You know, they have sort of one person who does lots of different boards, but many others have a single executive director. And like I say, this may be going way deeper than we want to go, particularly without testimony.
Well, one thing we could do, Senator Green, if you were willing, would be that it goes on to Senate Finance.
That'd
and
be fine.
We could explore it between now and then and see, and that way that would give Mr. Wayne time to really define what executive director is in the statute and who we want to. Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
Oh, that's fine.
Okay,
that's
so
fine.
We'll set aside that concept. Mr. Wayne, if you could go ahead and just prepare what you were going to, and then we'll work on that between now and Senate Finance. Okay, any further amendments to Senate Bill number 19 or further committee discussion? Okay, is there a motion?
Madam Chair, I would move Senate Bill number 19 as amendment onto the next committee of referral with individual recommendations. And is there a fiscal note?
Yes, two previous fiscal notes, and they are identified at zero.
And attached to zero fiscal notes. Thank you.
Okay, is there an objection to that motion? Hearing none, Senate Bill number 19 as amended has moved out. So that brings us now to Senate Bill number 20.
Madam Chair, could you take a short Eddie?
Yes, absolutely. We'll take a brief Eddie's. In state affairs, it's at 10 to 10, and we have Senate Bill number 20 before us for the first time, and public testimony on Senate Bill number 20. Let me go to my sheets here. Okay, I've got Mr. John Farley in Anchorage to testify under Senate Bill 20. Are you there, Mr. Farley?
Yes, we're here.
Hey, go ahead and state your name and who, if any, affiliation, what, if any, affiliation you have, and your testimony on Senate Bill number 20.
Well, my name is John Farley. I'm a lifelong resident of Anchorage. In fact, I'm a fourth-generation Alaskan, and I represent no one but myself, and perhaps I might be speaking for some other Alaskans as well. My testimony today is not specific to any one bill, nor is it specific to legislative versus executive ethics. I'm speaking towards the ethics of any policymaker, be they legislative or executive. I mentioned that I'm a fourth-generation Alaskan. I usually don't mention that because typically when someone mentions how long they've been in Alaska, the implication is that their testimony or their opinion is more valuable because they've been here longer. I personally don't subscribe to that theory, but I mention it for a different reason. Last night on the news, they interviewed a young couple who had just moved here, and it was in a story about the new city slogan, and they were all excited because they said, back home, we have to drive 5 hours to go skiing. Here, it's right next door. Well, my point is that they consider wherever they came from back home. For me, as a fourth-generation Alaskan, this is back home. I have no other home. And so I'm deeply embarrassed that the federal government has to come and clean up our mess here. There's been obvious signs for years about things that didn't seem right, and yet nothing was done until this crisis came along of the FBI coming in investigating our legislature here, and that seems it's embarrassing to me as an Alaskan that we're viewed as a corrupt state, and I think it's time to change that. I think that it's appropriate that both that any policymaker be held to a high standard, and that that even the appearance of impropriety needs to be dealt with. We need to be able to trust our government. Most of the suggestions that I've read about in the news seem like very smart suggestions. I support Representative Harris's concept of disallowing legislative spouses to be lobbyists. But I believe that it ought to be expanded to not just spouses, but any immediate family member. Sons, daughters, parents, siblings, they are all possible conduits for bribes. And it seems to me that any immediate family member of a policymaker should be under scrutiny as well. Last night, we watched a movie, and at the end of the movie was the typical disclaimer about, if you copy this movie, blah, blah, blah. And my 14-year-old son goes, you mean you could spend 5 years in jail and get fined $250,000 for copying a movie? And I said, yes, that's the law. And he said, then why is it that a politician who breaks the law can only be fined $5,000? It doesn't seem right. And, you know, I believe he's correct on that. It seems to me that if our policymakers sell us out for their own benefit, there ought to be significant penalties. And I'm talking about at least six-figure fines and potential jail time if the violation is egregious enough. It just seems to me that the fines and penalties that are available to the to APOC and the decision and to the courts are just not adequate to dissuade policymakers from operating in their own benefit instead of the benefit of all Alaskans.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Farley. I appreciate your testimony. Okay, I've got Stuart Thompson in Wasilla for testimony on Senate Bill number 20. Mr. Thompson, are you there?
Yes, I am. I'm in Ketchikan physically, but...
Okay.
Okay, so this is Stuart Thompson, a respectable constituent of Senator Green's, currently working in Ketchikan. I appreciate the specific help from Senator French's office that has resulted in me coming before you. I represent only myself as a citizen. Madam Chair and other senators present, I thank you in advance for your attention to my 4.5 minutes of prepared testimony that has been prefaxed to you by this LIO. May I proceed? I take that as an assumption. Here it is. Here are my overall thoughts for the ethics bill deliberations of the legislature, like on SB 20. Lawmakers are not inherently evil ogres. Lawmakers are human beings who need support to resist temptations that appeal to their imperfections. Since the natural imperfections of human beings are why government is even necessary, how to govern the governors is what defines form of government. In other words, a form of government is any design for minimizing corruption and poor administration by those wielding government powers. This makes the conceptual understandings of our constitutions and their philosophical foundations the most powerful resource for dealing with political corruption that can ever be, short of the supreme being. The philosopher Socrates demonstrated that inadequate comprehension of a subject's key words prevents the affected person from understanding the subject well enough to constructively apply it. I suggest lawmakers and citizens use this wisdom towards ethics in government. Example, corruption is a condition of being noun derived from the verb corrupt. American Heritage Dictionary provides five easy definitions for this verb, and so forth.
Okay. Just to note for the record, Mr. Thompson's testimony has been typed out and is included in your packet, and so it will be included into the public record indelibly. Okay. Let's see here. Mr. Wayne, did you have anything to comment on, or Mr. Jones? Mr. Wayne?
And we're talking about SB 20?
That's correct. Okay, I'm going to take that as a no.
Not specifically. I'm open for questions, though.
Okay, Mr. Jones?
No, Madam Chair, I do not.
Okay, anybody else here in the audience for Senate Bill 20? Anyone else online? Okay, hearing none, public testimony is closed on Senate Bill number 20. It brings it back before us. I have one amendment here before us, and let me go ahead and I'll just do the same we did last time, Senator Stevens, if that's okay. I'll move it as amendment number one and have you object.
And which one is that?
And this is M.4.
You object.
Okay. What this amendment would do is require disclosure. It closes a loophole that is in the seeming to be in the statute right now. So the general rule is that if you're a lawmaker, you have to disclose your sources of income while you're a lawmaker. It used to be over $5,000, now it's over $1,000. What we're doing in lines 8 through 12 is we're saying that just because you decide not to run for re-election again, or maybe you get defeated, that period of time in that last year that you were a lawmaker, you still have to disclose your information, and that makes sense. And I actually don't know how people have done that in the past. Some people may have just done it anyway, some people may not have, but I think this just closes that gap and makes it clear that you can't spend your last year in office sort of doing what you want and then as a legislator and then not disclosing that income received. So that would close that. The more controversial part of this amendment, And the reason it's in there is just because we took it directly from Governor Palin's bill, is that it also would now include a legislative employee, making them subject to disclosure requirements. And I wanted to, so that's the part of the amendment that's, I'd like to bring, I don't think the amendment as a whole is controversial, at least I haven't heard any controversy about it, but maybe including legislative employees and requiring them to be subject to the same financial disclosures we are would be. So I'd like to have a committee discussion on that, and I'm open to an amendment to this amendment. To the extent, Senator Green.
I agree with you on that. I don't think the legislative employee should be in there because that goes pretty deep. But I see it's part of the original bill as well, but what is the public member of the committee? What is that referring to?
I believe those are the public members of the Select Committee on Ethics.
I
is what I'm...
Okay, that's what that's under.
Mr. Wayne, are you there to just clarify that?
I am, and the public member of the committee is talking about the Ethics Committee.
Okay,
yeah. Thank you.
So those are the five public members.
Okay,
is there further discussion? I was... Senator Stevens.
Yeah, just to clarify this now, a seated legislator does not have to report 90 days after your final day of service. You report... What is the schedule when we have to report? Just remind me of that.
Soon.
March 15th.
March 15th.
And it covers the preceding fiscal year. So what has happened is you've left this kind of gap that for folks who are on, let's say, the fourth year of a four-year term, they're no longer a lawmaker. And the perception, again, I think it's been unclear. At least this is how the ethics advisor says it. You know, some report... and some don't, but it would clarify that all members, even if you've left office, are required. Senator French?
There's that, Madam Chair, that you put very well, and there's also the matter of the short amount of time that you spend in the legislature after the beginning of the first of the year. That is, there's a small number of folks who were still in the legislature as of January 5th, 2007. Right, their terms didn't formally expire until the new group of legislators were sworn in the ceremonies in both chambers, whatever it was, January 10th or so. So there's that little, or later this year, because we met because of the new governor. So there's that short portion of a new calendar year that's been falling outside the disclosure requirements. This simply, I believe, closes that, at least with respect to legislators. I do want to talk a little bit about legislative employees when we get to that part of the discussion.
Senator Stevens.
I guess what I was trying to get at is that often we don't know if there's going to be a special session. I mean, so if we end on May 15th, you could say that you have to have it 90 days later, I mean, August 15th. But in fact, we might have a special session as we did this year in November. I'm wondering why you wouldn't just leave it at the March 15th reporting date rather than to say 90 days after the person's final day. And does that mean that if you end up a regular session on May 15th, 90 days later you make a report, and then if there's a special session in November, 90 days later you make another report or amended report? Or just a question. I mean, this is another thing to, I mean, I understand the testimony we've had, and I really appreciate the comments that we've heard from Mr. Farley and all, but there's a real onus on a legislator to keep all these dates in mind as to when you have to make a report. So to say 90 days after a regular session, that's another date to keep in mind. I'm wondering why we wouldn't just say March 15th like everyone else.
Yeah, has to do it. And Senator Stevens, let me clarify. It doesn't cover 90 days after the public the member has served the public. What it's saying is that no later than 90 days after the person's final day of service. That's what triggers how long you have to file. So you've got 3 months.
So is that the December date? That's your final day of service?
No, we're making it. We would like to make it the last day of the member's service. So in this instance, let's say you were a lawmaker that was defeated this year. Your last day of public service, so long
well,
as
let's not say that. Let's find another way.
Okay. Let's say you were somebody who decided to go spend time with your family and go into a new chapter of your life. So and so long as you didn't step down officially, then you would have been holding office right up until 11 a.m. on the 16th of January. And so what we want to do is say that the disclosure is going to go all the way up until that day. So you couldn't, let's say, on the 5th or 6th of January, while you're still technically the chair of whatever committee and the member of whatever committee and a member of the legislature, get some kind of lucrative contract and then use this loophole to fail to disclose it. So
the disclosure would still be on March 15th, as everyone else. Is that
yes.
My understanding?
Senator French?
And it's important to keep in mind, I think, Senator Stevens, you were talking about the last day of the session and so forth. It's important to keep in mind that that's not the operative date. It's that
right.
Last day that you're officially in office.
Yeah.
That's the demarker. And just parenthetically, we're looking at a way to get all those dates into one date. I agree with your point, which is that it's confusing. You've got POET accounts, APOC reports, disclosures, and, you know, I put them all up in a calendar and I underline them, and it's still a nightmare because you think you're going to miss one, and you usually can. And I think we should get them all down to one date, and that's a subject of a future bill.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
May I address the committee through the chair?
Who's speaking?
This is Dan Wayne from Legislative Legal.
Yes, Mr. Wayne.
I think I can maybe satisfy some of Senator Kelly's concerns. First, I'll give a little bit of
Mr.
background.
Wayne? Mr. Wayne?
Yes, can you hear me all right?
That's Senator Stevens, I think you're asking about.
Yes, okay, sorry.
I'm having trouble with names. It's just, yeah.
Anyway,
we need more coffee.
I think part of how this started was that the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics investigated the question of whether or not legislators should have to report after they leave office, should have to report for that tail end of their term. And up until recently, apparently they'd had been getting advice that said that they did not. Because there is a statute, an applicability statute within the Legislative Ethics Code that says that no provisions of this code, a provision of this code does not apply to former legislators unless it specifically states that it does. And so the various reporting provisions and deadline provisions didn't say this specifically applies to former legislators. And so it was interpreted, the code was interpreted as a whole as not requiring them to report. So the Ethics Committee investigated this inquiry, and they came out with an advisory opinion that said, we, the Ethics Committee, determine that the statutes as they currently stand do require former legislators, former legislative employees, and former public members of the committee to report just like everybody else with respect to anything that happened while they were serving. But they're still left this sort of maybe potentially misleading language in the applicability section. And also, an advisory opinion isn't really the same thing as a statute. So, that's kind of some of the background. Yeah. Now, the period of time that is covered by this is the period 30 days before the end of the regular session, all the way to the beginning of the next regular session. So any special sessions that come in between that time period, anything like that, that's all stuff that gets reported once a year on March 15th. So you don't, your time periods don't run from, the end of each special session and so forth. There's really one reporting period. There's this whole period of time that is sort of lumped together, and that's 30 days before the end of the regular session, all the way to the first day of the next regular session. And that's the period of time that previously some people were not reporting because they interpreted the statutes as they were being told that the statutes could be interpreted this way legally, that they didn't have to report for that time period because they were leaving office. So what this statute would do is say that all of those people, legislators, legislative employees, and public members of the committee, with respect to that time period between the two sessions, would have 90 days from the time they leave service to file that report.
We got it. Thank you very much. Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I guess in a condensed version is it's 90 days after you leave service. Has nothing to do with the end of a session. You may well, under normal or regular circumstances, leave service the moment your replacement is sworn in. However, I have noted in my experience here, at least in one occasion, legislator coming down, being sworn in, getting their office allowance, and then resigning. Not what I'd call high ethical example, but people do leave service at other times other than, for lots of reasons, possible reasons, other than their replacement being sworn in. So I think the time factor of 90 days after you leave service for a personal or health or whatever, get a better offer reason, well, a person could resign midterm. And so then they ought to report 90 days after that, or as is the normal course, 90 days after their replacement sworn.
Okay, further discussion on amendment number one. There's an objection that's been noted by Senator Stevens. Senator French.
On the topic of legislative employees, is this a good time to
yes.
discuss that?
Yes.
Could someone define who all the legislative employees are?
Mr. Wayne?
That would be anyone who's not a public member of the committee or who is not a legislator who is on the state payroll in connection with a job in the legislature. Sorry if that sounds a little legalistic, but
let me just give you some examples. Are the pages legislative employees?
I believe they are. If they are on the legislative payroll.
Are you a legislative employee, Mr. Wayne?
Yes, I am. Everyone in my office, up through the from the bottom to the top, is a legislative employee. Everyone in the building I work in, it's my understanding, they're all legislative employees.
All our staffers.
Yes.
The people that answer the telephones.
Yes.
Thank you.
And this doesn't refer to a legislative employee of the committee, perhaps? No?
I think it's meant to be the maker of the amendment maybe can tell us it's...
Well, this amendment, just to clarify the text, what I wanted to get to is to close this gap. But when the drafter did the amendment, he took it right out of Governor Palin's bill. So I thought it had already been done, and so my thought was, you're going to hear the discussion anyway, so let's bring it up this way, and then do we want to leave legislative employee in or out?
Madam Chair, I'm going to move an amendment to the amendment, okay. And that is to strike the words legislative employee from line 8 and line 10 of amendment number 1.
Okay. Is there an objection to the amendment to the amendment? Senator Bundy.
Object just for discussion. Certainly, I understand Page is not likely to go on and become a lobbyist. However, a longtime chief of staff who was a legislative employee could easily go on and become a lobbyist. So, is that question one? Do we want to exempt that person? And the other is, are they required now to make any financial disclosure?
Senator French, and then let's ask Mr. Wayne what the requirements are right now. Certainly, we don't want to go backward in time as to what legislative employees are required to do. Senator French?
A couple things to keep in mind. One, this is not about going to be a lobbyist. This is about making an annual financial disclosure of all your investments and so forth the way we do. It may be worthy of a separate discussion because there may be some highly placed legislative employees that have an enormous amount of influence, and maybe there's been a problem with them, and so I think that's perhaps the subject of a separate hearing. But this is simply about annual disclosures for all legislative employees, and I think it's overbroad. And so I think the amendments are basically a good idea to capture us in our last reporting cycle. But as far as including legislative employees and annual disclosures, I need to be convinced.
Madam Chair, that was the second half of my question there, that I don't believe they're now required to make financial disclosures, and I don't believe that that's something we should pursue.
And Mr. Wayne, my understanding is that right now legislative employees are required to report close economic associations, like if you're roommates and or if you work on campaigns or things like that. I think that's the current law, but could you clarify what are legislative employees required to do right now? And also the second layer of that is, if we remove legislative employee from this amendment, I hope we're not taking away from anything that's on the book. We just may make the decision not to add to it.
Well, there's a bit of confusion I think I need to clear up. The governor's bill and this bill without the amendment, Senate Bill 20 without the amendment, is only talking about financial disclosures under 24-6200. legislative employees are not currently required to make those. Sort of loophole that I mentioned earlier on that allowed people to not have to file any disclosure whatsoever about anything for that time period that I mentioned between sessions. that was something that was relevant to everyone, including legislative employees, because of the close economic association disclosures, the gift disclosures, things like that.
Okay. So just to clarify, Mr. Wayne, this amendment is not changing the statute with respect to what legislative employees are required to disclose. In other words, they have these close economic associations and so forth, but rather what it's doing is saying that whatever those disclosures are, as outlined in Title 24, they remain, but we're going to close the gap for them as well.
I couldn't have said it any better. Thank you.
That's a different deal then. Okay,
Madam Chair?
Yes?
This is Dave Jones. I apologize for the interruption.
That's okay. We can't see you, so go ahead and proceed.
Thank you. I wanted to make one point concerning the governor's bill, Senate Bill 64. It addresses this issue in Section 3 of the bill, which appears on page 3, lines 7 through 11. And in the governor's bill, we did not extend the disclosure requirements to legislative employees, but merely to the legislative director.
Oh.
May I address that through the chair? This is Dan Wayne in legal.
Yes.
The way I read the governor's bill is that it only dealt with the disclosure or financial disclosure requirements of 2460-200.
That's different.
And so I assume that was why they didn't add legislative employees, because they're not listed in a required report under 2460-200 financial disclosures. But what the governor's bill was also doing in that Section 3 was addressing the loophole that I mentioned earlier, and leaving legislative employees out. So,
yep.
But this thing that I drafted would do would be the same thing, only it would also close the loophole with respect to the reporting requirements under other sections by legislative employees. And since the legislative director is a legislative employee, legislative...
Broader term.
Yeah.
We get it. Okay, Senator French, do you want to remove your...
I will withdraw my amendment to the amendment.
Okay, so the amendment sits before us. Amendment number one, further discussion from the committee. Further debate? Is there... Senator Stevens, do you maintain your objection?
No.
Okay, so the objection has been withdrawn. Amendment number one carries. Further amendments to Senate Bill number 20. I am intrigued by the spousal lobbying provision, and I think it probably is a good one. I just don't know how to draft it on the fly, and I don't know, maybe Mr. Wayne could help us. I think that's a fair provision. I just don't know. Is that something that you could come up with on the fly?
No, it's not. I don't think so.
Okay. Anybody on the committee come up with it on the fly? This is applicability. Oh, okay. Shalon tells me there's amendment number two, M3. I'm going to move that. Amendment number two, relating to the applicability of the Legislative Ethics Act.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion.
Okay. I think this is just a conforming amendment. Is that correct, Mr. Wayne?
If I may, I mentioned earlier the wording problem in the applicability section of the Legislative Ethics Act that caused some folks to think that former legislators and employees and so forth didn't have to report for that last half of a year. So it just changes one word, or actually two words, down there to say unless a provision of the chapter specifically states that it applies. And so if you read this together with the amendment that just passed about disclosure required of former legislators and so forth, that the amendment that just passed would be the provision of the chapter that specifically states that the whole chapter is applicable to everybody, regardless of whether they're serving or not.
Okay. So does everybody understand it's more a technical amendment? Amendment number two.
Okay.
Do you maintain your objection, Senator French, I think?
No.
So any further objection? Hearing none, amendment number two carries. Let me take a brief at ease. And what we've decided, we want to get this bill moving, so we will work on language. There is no language before us, and the drafter doesn't have time on the spousal lobbying situation, so between this committee and Senate Finance, that can be worked on. So is there a motion for CS for Senate Bill number 20 as amended? Senator French?
Madam Chairman, I would move that CS for Senate Bill number 20 be moved out of committee with the individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal notes.
Okay, any objection? Senator Bundy.
I object just to make a comment. We spent all day listening to an ethics expert, and one of his points very clearly was try to do this as a single bill and not a piecemeal. I would just note that we appear to be ignoring his advice, and with that, we'll remove my objection.
Okay, thank you, Senator Bundy. Objection is removed, so, Senator Green.
Yeah, and at the same time, that man also told us that when he had tried that 14, 15 years ago as an omnibus bill, it failed under its own weight. And so there are a lot of ways to get to the solution on this.
Okay, further comments, Senator Friend?
I can't resist echoing that. I think today's proceeding really is a perfect example of why you need several small bills moving through the system, because as you add provisions, you weigh them down, and it just makes it more difficult to actually get the bill to the finish line. So I concur in Senator Green's remarks.
Further comments? Okay, hearing none, then there's no objection. So the CS for Senate Bill number 20, as amended with individual recommendations and accompanying zero fiscal notes, passes out of Senate State Affairs and on to the Senate Finance Committee. Our last item of business today is Senate Bill number 45 by Senator Olson, and this is the peace officer convicted of murder. We heard this bill last week, and if you recall, much of the discussion centered around when the color of authority was and wasn't, and so we've got an amendment here, and it says Senator Olson on it, and we can put my name, and we can put, who else wants to be on this? Amendment number one.
That's fine.
Okay, and French. Okay, so amendment number one, page two, line nine. This would be to go ahead and delete the phrase "was on duty at the time of" and insert "use the officer's authority as a peace officer to facilitate." And that gets at what I think was a unanimous agreement by the committee that, you know, just the fact of being a police officer isn't what we're looking at. It's that you use the color of your authority to in the commission of that murder. So I'll move amendment number one by French and McGuire. Is there an objection to amendment number one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, hearing none, amendment number one carries. Are there further amendments to this bill? Senator Bundy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. There's a second amendment that I'm sorry, I thought had been duplicated.
Okay, it's being duplicated as we speak.
It's a very simple amendment, if you'd like me to speak to
okay.
While you're waiting to
that'd
get
be,
it.
That'd be great.
I would move amendment number one and object for discussion.
Amendment number two.
Mm-hmm. Or two, excuse me.
Okay, and I'll object just to hear what it is.
Yeah,
where would
sure.
It go?
Take a brief at ease, Madam Chair.
Let's take a brief at ease. Back on the record. Okay, we're back in order. 10:25. When we went off the record, we had Senator Bundy had proposed amendment number two. I'd objected just to hear about it, and he's in the process of describing it. Senator Bundy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment, page two, line nine, would add the court finds clear and convincing evidence that the defendant, as a peace officer, abused his or her duty and authority at the time of the murder. Again, I guess this is a very egregious case, and we certainly don't want to see anything like this happen again. However, we also want to, perhaps following the bill sponsor's professional ethics, first do no harm. And I want to make sure that there aren't any unintended consequences when a police officer has to face that life-changing decision as to whether to use deadly force or not. And you've heard the testimony from Commissioner Monaghan about what goes through a person's mind, they ought to be in the state of mind, very clearly, in my opinion, where they're not abusing their authority at the time that they would have to make the decision to use deadly force. I think this would not reduce the attempt to make sure that police officers don't abuse that this bill is trying to achieve. I think that they don't abuse their authority and commit capital murder, but it also may reduce that additional millisecond pause that a police officer might have to review in his mind before he does make the decision to use deadly force and inhibit him from doing his job as he ought to do it, endangering himself or others.
Okay, and Senator Bundy, so your amendment actually would nullify the amendment that we just passed. It's a different way of getting at it. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I think it is another way of getting at it, yeah.
Okay, so we've just amended the law to read, to be clear, page 2, line 9, 5 says, use the officer's authority as a peace officer to facilitate the murder. Okay, so your language would say instead, the court finds clear and convincing evidence that the defendant as a peace officer abused his or her authority at the time of the murder. So you're putting in a standard clear and convincing.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator French, what's the standard right now? I'm just trying to think. I mean, implicit in use the officer's authority, the standard would be beyond a reasonable doubt?
For a sentencing provision, I think after Blakely, you have to prove every element beyond a reasonable doubt.
So clear and convincing is lower. It's a civil standard. It's unusual.
Yes.
Okay, so let's take a brief Eddie's.